On the KHSU magazine today, we are talking with Dr. Malina Abdullah. She is a professor and chair of Pan-African Studies at California State University, Los Angeles, and among the original group of organizers that formed Black Lives Matter movement. Dr. Abdullah's keynote speech kicks off the Humboldt State University Campus Dialogue on Race tonight at 5 p.m. in the Kate Buchanan Room. Thank you so much, Dr. Abdullah, for coming up to Humboldt State and giving the keynote speech and coming to KHSU.
Thanks for having me. It's beautiful here.
It is. Yeah. I hope you get to see a little bit of it.
Yeah, I did this morning. I took a little walk this morning, so it was really beautiful.
Before you gave a workshop to the students on student organizing, you got in a walk, huh?
Got in a walk, yeah.
Well, it was a really good workshop this morning, the bit I got to attend. About the history of student organizing and the importance of student organizing now, can you talk a little bit about...
Re-give the workshop?
I'm kidding. We don't have that much time, but, you know, not the whole history, but I'm really interested in how successful change is made, and it's important for people to feel that they can make a difference and can make a change, but it takes a lot of work. And
yeah. So this morning, what I tried to talk to the students about is I drew parallels between this moment that we're in, which in terms of Black liberation struggle, we can think of as the Black Lives Matter moment on the long continuum of Black freedom struggle, right? Draw a parallel between now and the Black Power era, right? Where we saw in both eras, a couple years into that iteration of Black freedom struggle, Black student movements rise up on campuses. So if we think about the founding, the start of the Black Power era is 1965, and then the student strike at San Francisco State jumping off in 1968, right? There's a parallel between, you know, the founding of Black Lives Matter in 2013 and then the uprising on campuses by Black students in late 2015, early 2016. And in terms of victories, it's important to understand that in 1968, without the student strike of 1968, we would have no ethnic studies disciplines. We wouldn't have these things that we've struggled for. And one of the things that I was pointing out to students, even their access to universities comes as a result of student struggle. So it's very important that we understand that when we fight, when we develop a vision, when we develop goals, when we are very clear about what steps we need to take to get to freedom, and then we engage in the struggle for that, we win. There's never been a time that we've lost. We always win. We have to just commit ourselves, we have to vision it, and we have to work for it and be willing to make some sacrifices for it.
Right. And like you said, with the ethnic studies program at San Francisco State, is that where it was? Was that right?
Yeah. The first Black Studies program in the world, department in the world, was San Francisco State University. So we should be really, really proud as a CSU that both the first and second Black Studies departments emerged out of the CSU. So first San Francisco State, then mine at Cal State LA was number two. And actually number three was Cal State Northridge. And so it was student struggles in the CSU in a public university setting, working class students along with their communities struggling for and establishing Black studies. And then all of the ethnic studies disciplines grew out of this struggle.
Well, and what I learned from your talk this morning is that the students shut down San Francisco State for months.
For months, they shut down. They refused to allow business as usual. We have to remember that we have to not just fall in line with what they tell us we can do. We have to be willing to disrupt systems and usher in what it is we really want.
I think, too, when you're a student, you're kind of a customer of your, you know, of your university or your college. I mean, you're paying to get an education, but you have power in that regard. You know that the organization, the university, exists to provide an education to people. And so if you're not happy with the education that you're getting or the way you're getting it, you do have a lot of power compared to like being out in the working world. And you know, you have a group of people that you can organize with that share values and all
right.
that.
And I'd actually go further than that when we're talking about the CSU as a public university system, right? So our students are more than customers, right? This is our university, right?
Taxpayers pay for it.
We are more than the customers. We're the owners. This is our university system. So we can make demands of a system that is supposed to be by and for the people. So if it's not offering what it is we're demanding, we have every right as the people of the state of California to shut the system down, to disrupt the system, to demand what it is we want. And we're in a time where, you know, demand needs to be made, right? Where we need to demand greater access. We also need to remember that the Cal State system was created to be a free system of higher education or tuition free system of higher education. But now we have students paying $5,000, $7,000 a year to go to a university that was supposed to be for the working class people of the state of California. So what kind of demands do we need to make around access? What kind of demands do we need to make around quality? And I'm going to say this, that we are now descending into kind of a state where university faculty are being treated as if we are factory workers who are supposed to churn out students as products. And that's not the way higher education is supposed to work. So the idea that we should be here like it's a 9-to-5, like we don't have any role in knowledge production or community engagement, is hugely problematic. So we also need to create the working conditions that are also translate into student learning conditions for our faculty. We need to open up the university so that it's a resource for an entire community, so everyone has access to this university system. And so we need to remember that these demands can be made, and if we make the demands and if we're visionary in them, we can usher in a kind of change that's really transformational.
Yeah, and I think in community organizing too, just what I've learned is that you can do the research to find the right solution, you know, to help people do the right thing, that they either don't have the political will or they can't be bothered or they don't feel like they have time to find solutions that actually improve quality of education or quality of whatever situation, and do their homework for them and then make them look like the hero. I mean, you know, let them look like they're doing something right, and it can be a real win-win.
Right. So there's people that we can absolutely make logical cases to and say, you know, if you really want to deal with student success, you know, that's the buzzword now in the CSU, right? Student success. If we really want to think about student success, we need to invest in departments and programs like our ethnic studies departments and programs, because there's nothing that is more successful in graduating our highest risk students than having culturally relevant pedagogy and disciplines for them, right? So students fare far better in ethnic studies disciplines and across, so they do better in their math classes when they take an ethnic studies class, right? So we can make logical arguments to some people, we can present the data, but then there's other people who are political operatives, right? Who don't really care what the truth is, right? And I'm not talking about the people in DC. I'm talking about people who are right here, right? Who are political operatives. And in those instances, what we have to do is think about how politics works. We have to compel them to do what we want. We have to make it more in their interest to do what we want than to not do what we want. And that means being willing to get out of line, not just make arguments.
Yeah. Well, I think your keynote speech this evening is going to be very compelling, too. And that's taking place at 5 o'clock at the K. Buchanan Room. It's open to the public. It's here on the HSU campus, but it's free and open to the public. And the title of your speech is Beautiful Struggle, Toppling White Supremacy, Building Black Power. Can you tell us about the beautiful struggle?
Sure. I think it's really important that as we see ourselves, as we engage in this moment of struggle, and we have to struggle in this moment, right? That we also build a movement that's truly beautiful. So the term beautiful struggle actually comes from Martin Luther King, right? And it's important that we build a struggle that is nurturing and restorative as we're engaging in transformational work, right? So the work of toppling white supremacy is a huge, you know, it's a very heavy lift, right?
Right.
But we can find beauty in the midst of it all by building also what King called a beloved community, by recognizing that there's something amazing that's going to be ushered in when we win, and we will win. And so that's the struggle we need to take on, and that the toppling of white supremacy comes in also several forms. There's the explicit white supremacy, the extremist white supremacy that we see come from DC and the Trump administration, but also the folks he's whipped up into a frenzy, even in places like Humboldt, right?
Yeah.
That have, you know, kind of feel like, I think one of the terms that's been used is their shackles have been removed. And so they feel free in their ability to kind of be extremist white supremacists, right? We have to absolutely topple that form. And as we're doing it, envisioning what racial justice looks like, we also have to topple the form of white supremacy that's more liberal, right? Mm-hmm. So there's liberal white supremacy that's more prevalent in states like California, where you have liberals ushering in gentrification, right? Really feeding a prison industrial complex with black and brown and poor bodies, right? Yeah. And how do we also topple the liberal brand of white supremacy? Because we need to end both if we're to get to racial freedom and justice.
Do you have an answer for that?
Yeah, I mean, we have to, Malcolm said that the battlefield is everywhere. It's absolutely everywhere, right? We have to fight on all fronts, right? And so that means that we have to be constantly engaged in a struggle. We can't let stuff go by us. We can't say, well, you know, I really like that person. They smiled at me. We have, like, we're in a selfie culture, right? Where we go, you know, some of these liberal politicians especially love to take pictures with us, and we kind of want to be close to power, so we'll take selfies with them. And then we don't think about what that means if we're not willing to challenge them. So we have to be willing to challenge them, and that doesn't just mean people of color either. It means white folks. White folks got to think about what kind of world that they want to live in, because you're fed, as white people, are fed the idea that white supremacy has something in it for you. And it does in the most kind of immediate sense, right? There's a material benefit and a psychic benefit that comes with living in a white supremacist society, and all white people get those benefits. But there's also a tying of yourself to a system that's oppressive that also holds you down, right? So it's an albatross around your neck as well. If you have to constantly look over your shoulder, because I'm gonna get my freedom, if you have to constantly look over your shoulder and wonder, what are black folks gonna do? What are brown folks gonna do? You know, how is my little, you know, gated self gonna fare when the struggle comes, right? Then you're shackled to an unjust system. So free yourself from that system and demand an end to white supremacy, demand racial justice as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's just a freedom from fear. I mean, I think, you know, our species is poorly evolved, you know? I mean, we just have more fear than we really have things to fear, it seems to me. But so, Dr. Abdullah, you know, in the past, with the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement, you could point to laws on the books that were unconstitutional, you know, that to segregation. You could say this law oppresses a whole group of people, but it doesn't really seem like we have those laws explicitly in writing on the books, you know, that you can point to clearly and say this law needs to be changed. It's a lot more subtle than that. You know, maybe things haven't changed, but it's not the law that people are discriminated against. In fact, they're not supposed to be. But if they still are, like, it seems like a tougher struggle because you don't have anything on paper to point to.
Right. And that's the transition from, you know, political demands and legal demands to power demands, right? So it's really important that we understand it's not just about what's explicit and what's on the books, right? In fact, even when we were challenging laws, right, the laws can seem benign, right? If we think about the Voting Rights Act wasn't about saying that there, remember, the 15th Amendment had been passed like 100 years before, almost 100 years before, right? So legally and technically, Black people had the right to vote. It was what the outcomes were,
right?
And so what the practices were, what the policies were that demanded that government go further to protect Black voting rights. And even now, we're seeing Black voting rights being rolled back,
yes,
right? Erosions of the Voting Rights Act. So that's happening. But I think that if we're to look at those struggles, a civil rights struggle, right, we can look at unjust policies and practices. So when you're talking about, you know, in my county, Los Angeles County, in less than 5 years, 300 people have been killed by police. Almost 300 people have been killed by police. Not a single police officer has been prosecuted in those killings, right? So what is the outcome? When we look nationally, last year, 1,100 people killed by police. Only 6 officers are even prosecuted nationally, right? It doesn't mean that they were convicted, because we know of all these acquittals, right? But charges pressed, right? And so we need to look at outcomes, not just the intent and explicit intent of laws, right? And then we get to something bigger, which is questions of power, right? How do we demand power for the people? And some of that's going to be tied to existing systems, but some of it's also going to have to go around existing systems. We need to reimagine things like public safety. Public safety isn't just tied to policing, to an oppressive system of policing, right? Public safety needs to be about what actually creates safe communities. And that kind of intertwines many different systems, right? How does our economic system, you know, inhibit how safe our communities are? If people don't have food, if people don't have the resources to survive, then your community is not safe. Right. If people's mental health needs aren't being addressed, then your community is not safe. And so we need to think about policy outcomes, and we need to be thinking about broader questions of power.
Dr. Abdullah, we just have a few more seconds left. You're going to be speaking tonight, 5 p.m. at the Cape Buchanan Room. It's free, open to the public. Is there something that you want people to walk away from or walk away with from your talk tonight?
Yeah, I mean, I want people to walk away with a sense that they can do something. They have a duty to do something. We always say in Black Lives Matter, it is our duty to fight for freedom. And I think that's all of our duty. It's our sacred duty to fight for freedom, not to just, you know, be complicit with an oppressive system. Here in Humboldt, I want to absolutely say the name Josiah Lawson, that we cannot let this go, that we have to struggle for justice for Josiah. And if local law enforcement, here's another issue with, you know, the limitations of law enforcement, right? If they're not going to get justice for him and us, because we're tied to him, then how are we going to demand justice? So we need to see ourselves as obligated to struggle for justice and be willing to put ourselves on the line in that justice struggle.